Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Here's today's oh wow moment from the world of science. It has to do with understanding addiction. Massachusetts researchers have pinpointed a part of the brain that is so central to addictive behaviors that they've been able to trigger nicotine withdrawal symptoms in mice, even when those mice have never even had a single drop of nicotine enter their bodies.
That's just one piece of exciting new research by scientists at UMass who are looking into the neurological causes of addiction. And it's the subject of our latest in our series of reports, Brain Matters, reporting from the front lines of neuroscience, which aired this morning on Morning Edition.
In a few minutes, we'll talk with one researcher about how innovative non-biological addiction therapies can change the brain. But first, we're joined by WBUR's Deborah Becker, who reported today's story. Deb, great to see you.
Thank you.
So first of all, you reported that scientists are actually finding that the brain does play a very powerful role in addiction.
That's right. And I think that of the studies that are being done at the University of Massachusetts Medical School's Brudnick Neuropsychiatric Research Institute, that's quite a mouthful, I know, but some of them are really interesting. And one of them that really stuck out in my mind was one that shows that the brain actually rewires itself. And what they found was that when someone moves through the stages of addiction, the brain tries to accommodate that, and it tries to shut off the part that deals with self-control. So that part can shut up a little bit so the person can continue to seek out the addictive substance. The study was done by Dr. Joseph DeFranza, and he is a family doctor and a professor at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and this is how he explains it.
And they've lost about two-thirds of the nerve fibers that are connecting the part of their brain that is responsible for the self-control to the part where the craving is generated. So people are facing some major obstacles when they try to quit because their brain is wired to support that addiction.
That is fascinating and actually kind of disturbing. So there's this feedback loop that changes the brain even more as an addiction progresses.
That's right.
Well, let's look at the other side of this, because you also spoke with researchers who are looking into the part or parts of the brain that are responsible for dealing with withdrawal. I mean, when substances or addicted substances are no longer in the body. What are they finding?
Well, it's interesting here because by looking at withdrawal specifically, the thinking is if they can tamper down withdrawal symptoms, perhaps they can then figure out a treatment that could alleviate those symptoms for people and make it easier for them to quit whatever the substance might be. So this was a study that was done by Andrew Tapp, and he did studies with mice, and he identified this area of the brain that he thinks is responsible for withdrawal symptoms. And this is how they knew that that was the area of the brain. Let's listen.
We were able to cause nicotine withdrawal symptoms even in an animal that had never seen nicotine before, and that was sort of the aha moment that linked that particular brain region and a certain group of neurons within the brain region to nicotine withdrawal symptoms directly.
And scientists hadn't seen this before.
No, that was sort of something new that they've only done it in mice thus far, but obviously they believe that that can work in humans as well.
So how does all this new science that's coming out of the lab, how could it possibly affect or inform treatment?
I think that overall what they're saying, many of the researchers at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, what they're saying is that it's very complex. Well, and we knew some of this already, but there are different regions of the brain that are affected at very different levels and affected by different substances. But they say that it's going to likely always have to be an individualized form of treatment that has to be tailored to the person involved and has to include multiple things. Gene King, who's a psychiatry professor at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, explains the thinking behind this.
Well, you can't go in like certain diseases and you fix it. This is a disease that you could fix it now and 10 years later somebody could go back to drugs. The insidious thing about addiction is it is this disease that never really quits.
So Meghna, essentially what they're hoping is that they can ease some of the symptoms and maybe do that and make some headway, but whether there will ever be one cure, I'm not sure anyone is optimistic that we're even close to that yet.
Yeah. There were so many fascinating things in your report this morning, and I did want to ask you one more thing about that, and that is that, you know, we've been talking about the brain as this complex biological and chemical system that interacts in these remarkable ways with the disease of addiction, but one of the innovative treatments that you profile today has nothing to do with a chemical treatment at all.
That's right, right. That's mindfulness and meditation. And what was fascinating was talking with folks who struggle with substance abuse issues and are using meditation, because they portray it in a way that it almost fits into the kind of treatment that we already know a lot about, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps. And they say with mindfulness, they feel as if they're connecting to this higher purpose, which is really what a lot of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous advocate. And the scientists here are finding that that connection actually quiets the part of the brain that a lot of people associate with craving. So there is something scientific to this mindfulness. So they're actually finding the science that backs up some things that have been around for a very long time.
Well, in just a second, we're going to talk in more detail with one of the mindfulness experts that you spoke to for your piece. But WBUR's Deborah Becker, whose report on addiction and the brain is part of our series Brain Matters, reporting from the front lines of neuroscience. Deb, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Dr. Judson Brewer. He's the director of research at UMass Medical School Center for Mindfulness, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start right where Deb left off. She said that mindfulness techniques can actually quiet parts of the brain central to addiction. Have researchers actually been able to witness or document that quieting through neural imaging of any kind?
We've done some work with experienced meditators and novices to look at the differences between these two, and it seems that in experienced meditators, some of these regions get pretty quiet when they're meditating.
Okay, so there's an actual physical change in the brain using mindfulness techniques.
There's an activity change, absolutely.
An activity change, okay. So does that help us understand this issue of what Deb was talking about earlier, that in the brains of people who are suffering from addiction, the brain's actually rewiring itself that exacerbates addiction? Is mindfulness training undoing that rewiring or creating new neural networks? Or what exactly is it doing to the brain?
My guess is, and there's a lot more work that needs to be done, but it's probably doing some of each. It's kind of letting go of some of these old pathways that are really wired and laid down over time, time and again, each time somebody uses, and also developing new ones to help people work with and kind of not get caught up in these addictions.
Mm. So when speaking about mindfulness and meditation in treating addiction, what exactly are we talking about? What specific techniques have you done research on?
We've studied a number of different types of meditation techniques, but the basic premise, or one that links all of them, is really just paying attention, being aware of what's going on right now, as compared to being lost in, you know, thoughts about the past or worries about the future.
Mm. I can imagine, though, that for someone suffering from addiction, that's especially hard because of the neurological and biological demands of their addiction itself.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, you talked in Deb's piece this morning about this default mode network.
Yes.
Well, what is that?
This seems to be what we all default to when we're not doing anything in particular. And so if somebody says, oh, just don't do anything in particular, we start doing all sorts of things related to ourselves. We think about what we're going to have for dinner. We worry about things that we did previously. We start planning our day for tomorrow, those types of things. We default to these types of things.
Hmm. So I wonder if you could just tell me in a little bit more detail of some of the research that you have been doing. I mean, do people suffering from addiction, do they come in and is it group work, or do they take the meditation techniques out into the world with them? What are you asking them to do?
We started with smokers in particular. We just asked them to pay attention when they're smoking. That's the first thing we start with. And some of them say, what? I thought this was a smoking cessation program. And we say, well, just pay attention when you're smoking and see what you actually get when you smoke.
Okay, if I might interrupt, sorry. When paying attention when you're smoking, like, what are you asking them to pay attention to?
To every aspect of smoking. What does it feel like when they're pulling that cigarette up to their mouth? What does it feel like when they're taking that first drag? What does it feel like as that smoke is going into their lungs? And typically it's I'm really craving a cigarette and I'm going to smoke and I feel better. But when you pay attention when you're doing this, you start to notice, oh, this is actually really hot smoke that doesn't taste very good. One of our patients said, you know, when she did her first mindful smoking exercise, she said, smells like stinky cheese and tastes like chemicals. Yuck. So she just paid attention to what she'd been doing 20 times a day.
For years, I presume.
Yes.
And never had that particular reaction.
Right.
Oh, interesting. And that came about within what? One or two sessions of paying attention?
The first time she did it.
The first time. Sorry, I didn't hear that. I actually should be more mindful in this moment now myself. Forgive me. So that's amazing. And then did this particular person, did it trigger further changes in her behavior after that?
She was using our app and online program, so we didn't follow her all the way to the end. But presumably, that's kind of like pulling down on Santa Claus's beard. You can't go back and pretend that Santa Claus isn't real anymore. So each time we do these and we see, wait, it's not really as good as I thought it was, we start to become disenchanted from smoking or any other type of behavior that we thought was, or our brains have tricked us into thinking were a good idea.
Mm. Now, do we have any research so far that may demonstrate the overall efficacy of using mindfulness to really unlock people from their addictive behaviors?
There have been a few studies that have been done. There was a group down out at University of Washington that's done some large-scale studies. We've worked with alcohol and cocaine-dependent individuals, and we've also worked most recently with smokers and found that in a randomized control trial, mindfulness was actually twice as good as gold standard treatment.
Twice as good in terms of long-term effect or speed of coming clean, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, abstinence. So people quitting smoking, biochemically verified 4 months later.
Wow. That actually sort of almost preempts the next question I was going to ask, which is mindfulness training enough? Or, could potentially, because Deb was talking about in our conversation with her, that every person will, best benefits from very specialized treatment programs. So could it be mindfulness plus, say, some chemical treatment as well?
Yeah, for some individuals, mindfulness might be enough. For others, that paired with a medication might be very helpful to help them with the withdrawal symptoms as they're going through it. You can think of the medication helping people work with that physical withdrawal as they start to learn the skills to be able to deal with their own psychological cravings, which we haven't found good medications for yet that will help them stay abstinent long term.
Hmm. And do people, you said that there's an app. Does the app work as well as getting actually having one-on-one coaching?
We're starting to test that now. It's a great question. So we've just gotten some funding from the National Cancer Institute to study that in a large randomized controlled trial. So check back in a couple of years and we'll let you know.
We definitely will. But exciting new news on the potential of mindfulness training when it comes to helping those suffering from the disease of addiction. Dr. Judson Brewer, Director of Research at the UMass Medical School Center for Mindfulness. Thanks so much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.